Hardest job in the world comes with two free houses, a fleet of cars, and some planes.
The hardest thing about the job is staying focused because there's so many demands and decisions that are pressed upon you.
President Barack Obama looks at some huge challenges ahead. The clock is ticking on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, March 23rd. I'm John Hockenberry. The president was on 60 Minutes last night. He's been everywhere. Well, not quite. We're relying on you to tell us where he should go next. Coming up this hour, President Obama's message resonated with Iranians. We'll talk about that and access to clean water in developing countries and take a look at conditions in America's maximum security prisons. Supermax. All that coming up, but first some headlines. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, his focus this morning is on toxic assets. Later this hour, he's expected to unveil a plan for the government to buy up to $1 trillion worth of bad debt. Dow futures are up around 200 points ahead of the announcement. The president's focus is energy. He's expected to talk up the parts of the budget that deal with clean energy technology. He wants to put billions toward it. It's part of his plan to move the U.S. toward energy independence. And the FAA says all 14 people on board a private plane that crashed in Butte, Montana are believed dead. The plane was bound for Bozeman, Montana, and left from Oroville, California. The cause of the accident is not yet known. Mark Garrison, what else we got going?
Good morning, John. The president says confronting problems in Afghanistan is not going to be easy. This is more from that 60 Minutes interview we just heard.
Iraq was actually easier than Afghanistan. It's easier terrain. You've got a much better educated population, infrastructure to build off of. You don't have some of the same destabilizing border issues that you have between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
The president says the U.S. will have to amp up its diplomatic efforts in the region in addition to increasing its military presence. There's another deadly plane crash today involving Americans, this one in Japan. The American pilot and co-pilot of a FedEx cargo plane have been confirmed dead.
Did you see those pictures?
Yeah. You just see like bounce like that.
Totally
security cameras caught.
Oh,
it's hard to watch. But the plane was coming from China. Investigators believe wind may have been a factor. It was blowing almost 50 miles an hour where it was there. Also, Alaska's Mount Redoubt began erupting just a few hours ago. That's a first in 20 years. John.
Also some amazing pictures. We should get that on our website. Thank you, Mark Garrison. And the Dow and S&P both fell about 2% on Friday. The Dow kicks off at 7278. The S&P starts trading at 769. Futures trading way, way up. They're on fire in anticipation of the announcement on toxic assets from Timothy Geithner. We'll have more about that in just a moment. But President Obama has been hard to miss. Right, Mark?
You bet.
Yeah, you got him on YouTube, right?
Always.
60 Minutes.
I subscribe to the
right.
channel.
There
Check
was a, there was a C-SPAN all last week. He was like a headliner. Where should he pop up next? Saturday Night Live sketch, perhaps? What do you think? Infomercial? Come on, Mark. Would you rather hear his message or prefer him behind closed
doors?
Sing it.
Good morning, John. This is Mark from Massachusetts. I don't think he's looking for points in the pop culture. He's looking for everyone to know that the work is being done, and we all need to pay attention to it.
Of course he's not. Whether it's Mark in the studio or Mark in Massachusetts, what's your take? 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. What reassures you more, a president behind the scenes solving problems or out with the people?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So last week, it was a veritable media blitzkrieg. Barack Obama was everywhere. He went everywhere. He was everywhere. 60 Minutes last night, we've already talked about. What'll it be this week? Well, look at your calendar. It's Monday morning.
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on?
What's going on? Well, that means Monday morning is a look at the agenda in Washington, the kinds of things that we want you to stay focused on this week as we look ahead. And there's a lot to look at. Not a lot of atmospherics. There's hard policy being made in Washington. Today, the toxic asset program gets announced. Tomorrow, Barack Obama gives a news conference. Later on in the week, a multilateral conference on Afghanistan convenes with the U.S., Russia, and Iran all in attendance. Hillary Clinton is going to be in Mexico to talk about all of this. Marcus Mabry, international business editor of the New York Times, joins me here in the studio. Marcus, thanks for joining.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here in this lonely studio all by myself. Thank you so much. Also, Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine in Washington, D.C. We welcome her back to the program. Jay, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk right at the beginning here with the Geithner show, which convenes once again. Timothy Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, is going to outline, along with other members of the administration, his plan for dealing with so-called toxic assets. Jay Newton Small, how important is this? And Geithner's gotten mixed reviews as he's been rolled out on various occasions, at least as far as the market is concerned.
Well, look, Geithner isn't the first Treasury Secretary to not be the most eloquent of guys. I don't think Hank Paulson was ever accused of being charming, or at least not being able to charm politicians very well, or that eloquent, frankly, about the economy. So, yeah, Geithner's off to a rocky start, and this is the most important program of his tenure at Treasury, no doubt. This is what they expect will be the engine to restart the economy, and he's announcing it this morning on a conference call with reporters at 8:45 a.m.
Note for a moment that Geithner, for all of his troubles, is kind of going solo at this point. He doesn't have much in terms of his team, and it's something that Barack Obama actually referred to when he spoke on 60 Minutes yesterday. Take a listen.
This whole confirmation process, as I mentioned earlier, has gotten pretty tough. It's been always tough. It's gotten tougher in the age of 24/7 news cycles, and a lot of people who we think are about to serve in the administration and Treasury suddenly say, well, you know what, I don't want to go through some of the scrutiny and embarrassment in addition to taking huge cuts in pay.
Now, that's in the context of, first of all, the difficulties of being president in the 21st century in the midst of all this. But Jay Newton Small and Marcus, maybe let me direct this to you, Marcus. Geithner doesn't have his deputies named yet. The confirmation process has already been difficult. He's doing this kind of solo.
He is. He really is out there by himself. And to some extent, if you watch that 60 Minutes interview last night with the president keeps saying how, oh, Tim's doing a great job and, I've got utmost confidence in him. And it kind of keeps feeling like he's pushing Tim out there and saying, Tim's your man. Tim's really trying. I really believe in Tim. when in fact, it's the president who I think is responsible for the support the administration still has going in on this.
Still a smart move, though, really.
Oh, well, look, it's the Treasury Secretary has to be the guy leading this. It has to be. You need one single force, one single personality out there, and hopefully Geithner will find his stride this week. But this week, the story this week is going to be this. It's going to be money palooza.
Right.
So you got banks, you got budget, and you got bailouts. And so that was the bank piece of it. Bailout piece is going to be that AIG is going to continue to harass this administration. And going forward, it's going to be the $3.6 trillion budget, which is really going to be something that we're going to be talking about a lot this week as the House and Senate take them up.
Before we talk about the budget, Control Room, were you recording there where he said money palooza? I want to make sure that we were recording on that. Yeah. to both of you, Jay and Marcus, there's a separation of powers issue here. When the government is borrowing so much, and so much of financial policy is the result of Treasury decisions and Federal Reserve decisions, It's almost as though, Jay, the White House is more powerful than Congress. The power to collect and lay taxes in the Constitution is not as important as your ability to borrow in this environment, and they can get this entire program passed without even going to Congress. Right, Jay?
Well, I mean, they can start it without going to Congress, but they can't finish it. I mean, what they're going to need to do is go back to Congress, and Geithner already laid out a sort of place setter in the budget this year, up to about $750 billion in a sort of TARP. I don't know, what is it, 2.5, TARP 3, TARP 4 now, that's going to happen, which is the Toxic Assets Relief Program. They're going to have to go back to Congress and ask for more money at some point. Obviously, this week is probably not the week they're going to do it, since Congress has still got a big bee in their bonnet about AIG and these bonuses that are paid out to these executives. But they're going to have to go back soon and ask for that money, because they cannot do it without it.
The budget is definitely, both of you referred to, the budget is definitely on the agenda this week. But I'm wondering if the budget is the Democrat budget, that there will be actually an alternative that's suddenly proposed by the Democrats, or are we going to see some serious modifications of the Obama budget? Marcus, you first, and then Jay.
I think it's going to be interesting to see how the Democrats play this, because with the president's first shot at fiscal policy, they didn't really let Republicans in. We're going to see if they do it this time, because the Republicans have complained they've not been a part of the process. If the if it's a Democrat versus Democrat debate, then I don't think it's going to be politically successful.
All right. Well, let's listen to some of those complaints. Here's Democratic Senator Kent Conrad complaining about the budget and complaining about the deficits. And, Jay, I want your response when we come back.
We have got to get back to a more sustainable fiscal circumstance. We cannot have debt pile on top of debt. We cannot run budget deficits in the out years of over $1 trillion a year.
Jay Newton-Smull, he can say that all he wants, but that's what they're doing.
Well, they definitely, the budget this week, the Congressional Budget Office report on the president's budget this week was a big blow to them because, you know, Obama had been saying that he'd like to see the budget go back down to about 3% of GDP right now, or this year it'll be about 6% of GDP, which is the gross domestic product. Basically what the Congressional Budget Office said was, actually, we're going to stay about 4 to 6% of gross domestic of GDP for the next 10 years, and it's going to be $1 trillion deficit as far as the eye can see. So, you know, in terms of trying to convince Republicans or convince even fiscally conservative blue dogs in the House to vote for this thing, that was probably not the best PR-ish item to come out this week, but they don't really need Republicans to vote for this
right.
week. I mean, they need about 2 in the Senate, but other than that, you know, they've just got to hold their own.
So at the news conference, will that argument be made, Marcus, on Tuesday, come in from the cold Republicans, or just forget about it?
Well, you know, I think actually he's not going to be any more conciliatory than he has been. He's viewed by the public, the president, that is. He's viewed by the public as having been conciliatory toward the Republicans and reaching out. I think what the Tuesday press conference is going to be about, it's going to be about making sure that this week does not become like last week was, you know, a tribute to AIG and the excess of its $165 million in bonuses. He's going to try to emphasize we can not, as he said last week, he's going to try to emphasize that we've got to keep moving forward. We cannot keep looking backwards at things like the AIG bailout because, frankly, as Jay said, they're going to be looking at next week the auto companies. And the president actually
right.
said this weekend that it will be politically difficult to help the auto companies. That's kind of extraordinary.
And there may be another AIG problem. Richard Holbrooke, the Afghan envoy and diplomat, long-standing diplomat, was on the AIG board in early 2008 when these bonuses were locked in. Let's not talk about that for a moment, but it's likely to come up this week. Hillary Clinton is in Mexico. To both of you, this is both a domestic story and a foreign story. Marcus, is it drug wars or is it actually political stability in Mexico that's on the table when the Secretary of State goes to Mexico?
Well, she's going to be talking about the $500 million Merida initiative, as they call it, the State Department, which is an interagency U.S. plan, $500 million to help Mexico fight crime and especially drugs and drug interdiction and give the Mexicans some more force behind them that the Americans are sponsoring, but the Mexicans are going to want to talk about Mexican trucks and how the president signed a bill in Congress that keeps those trucks off the road. The Mexicans slapped on a bunch of punitive tariffs against American products, represented by some 40 states. So that's what they're going to want to talk about.
Very
She's going
big,
to talk about
yeah.
drugs.
All right. So Jay Newton-Smull, as a consumer, as an auto consumer, would you buy a Nano?
Well, you know, I already have a car, but hey, I mean, like, these little, it's got good gas mileage. Why not?
The Indian car maker Tata rolls out the Nano, just one of the things on the agenda today. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times in our studio, and Jay Newton-Smull, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, located in Washington, D.C., talking about the agenda. That's your agenda for this Monday.
I do think in Washington, it's a little bit like American Idol, except everybody is Simon Cowell.
Wow.
This will be a very
useless.
Different week on the agenda this week. So where should Obama be next? 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Be his media advisor, won't you?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Last week, it was about the President Obama media blitz. This week, it's more about problem solving in Washington. Which do you prefer, a president behind the scenes solving problems or one on Leno and other media outlets talking to Americans and hearing their concerns? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And what venue would you like to see the president on next? Face the Nation? Law and Order? How about an episode of The Office? You can tell us. Well, there's been reaction to President Obama's media blitz from Iran. Very tangible media reaction because of the president for the season of the holiday of Nowruz, the Persian holiday of Nowruz, which is the spring festival in Iran and parts of South Asia. The president had a message that was delivered on video via the internet and channels throughout that region, particularly to the people and leadership of Iran. Here's President Obama on that video referring specifically to the Iranian poet Sadi.
There are those who insist that we be defined by our differences. But let us remember the words that were written by the poet Sadi so many years ago. The children of Adam are limbs to each other, having been created of one essence.
So the president's outreach to the people of Iran is not unprecedented. Others in the past have delivered messages via media channels that were likely to be viewed by the people of Iran. But we wanted to get a direct reaction, if we could, from Tehran and to Iranians, many of whom live here in the United States. Cyrus Rezaghi is a marketing consultant from Tehran. He joins us from the Caspian coast. Cyrus, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, and hello to you from the sunny Caspian seaside.
Oh, I'm jealous. I'm absolutely jealous. Amir Farouki is an Iranian-American, an Atlanta attorney who is running for a seat on the Atlanta City Council. Amir, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, Cyrus, did you see the message from Barack Obama, and what was the context in which most Iranians were likely to have viewed this video?
Yes, John, I think most people have seen it either directly on TV, satellite TV, and or on websites. And what was remarkable, besides the usual eloquence and almost flawless delivery, was President Obama's sincerity. It was almost emotional, and that was, in my opinion, as powerful, if not more, than the message, the content itself. So it came across very genuine, very sincere. And that was quite a difference from previous presidents and officials, American officials, who attempted to basically come across as sincere and basically build a bridge.
Okay.
Generally, very well. Yes. Go ahead.
All right, Amir Farouki here in Atlanta. President Bush coined the axis of evil phrase. I mean, in a sense, it would be hard for Barack Obama or any president to be more confrontational with Iran than President Bush was. So how do you think this was received?
I think in the Iranian-American community in the U.S., even though there's a wide range of political opinion, you have Republicans, you have Democrats, you have independents, it was overwhelmingly it received an overwhelmingly positive reception. I think this is the first time in decades in which the message is not only, I think, an adult message. It wasn't simplistically antagonistic, but it showed a very nuanced and, I think, long-awaited appreciation for Iranian civilization and Iranian culture. And it also acknowledged the contributions of Iranian Americans to the United States, which while not kind of central to political necessity, has been lacking in that in the communication between the American administration and the Iranian administration.
So a sense of sincerity and hitting the right points from the perspective of Iranians in Iran and Iranians here in the United States. To both of you, let me pose this question then. It's just one message. It seems in the past that even though there might have been glimmers of hope between the United States and Iran, ultimately the default position is for America to go to a we don't trust Iran, remember the hostages kind of position, and that the Iranians go to a default kind of remember they're the great Satan, the clergy runs things in this country. What's to prevent those default options from being real? Cyrus, you first, and then Amir.
Sure. I think just another point to add, John, was that the message was very polite, very professional, and direct to the Iranian leadership. So President Obama called Iran the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the official name of the country. As Amir mentioned, he recognized the achievements of Iranians inside and outside of Iran. And that's a great, positive start. Now, the response from Iran has been cautious, but definitely positive. If these nice messages are backed by small gestures, and by small gestures, I mean gestures that do not pose any risks to America, such as lifting, partial lifting of sanctions on civilian aircraft sales, or things that are not posing any threat to America, definitely Iran will respond.
All right. Amir, why don't you give us the last word? What do you think? What will prevent us from going to the default position of being so separated?
Well, I think we're both sides are operating from the default position, and neither side is abandoning its national security or foreign policy interests. But the type of message that President Obama gave begins to create an environment that allows both sides to save face and provides a mutual respect that's been lacking, I think, in the conversation between the two sides. We tend to underestimate the power of recognizing another, particularly a historic culture's past and contributions, and that goes an incredibly long way to creating an environment of mutual respect that allows for hopefully productive diplomatic discussions. And if those fail, both sides will probably fall back on their default positions.
Well, where does it go? We will see this week, later this week, a discussion on Afghanistan, and a conference begins where Iran and the U.S. will be at the same table. From the voices of the people of Iran themselves, I'd like to thank my reacting guests, Amir Farouki, Iranian-American Atlanta attorney running for a seat on the city council there, and Cyrus Razaghi, a marketing consultant who joined us from the beautiful Caspian coast in Tehran. Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will officially announce a plan in just a few minutes to buy up as much as $1 trillion in bad assets from banks. The idea is to free banks up so they can get back to lending money to consumers, to businesses. The money will come from the government and from private sector. Geithner wants the private sector to get involved because it spreads the risk of buying bad debt. Last night, President Obama continued his campaign for the economic recovery plan. He was on CBS's 60 Minutes. He defended Geithner there. He also declined, though, to endorse the House bill to tax bonus recipients from bailed out firms like AIG instead of a bill to penalize a few people. The president says he wants to focus on the larger issue of economic recovery. Major flooding expected in the Midwest this week. Emergency workers in Fargo, North Dakota are coordinating massive sandbagging along the Red River. That river runs along the North Dakota-Minnesota border. It's 3 feet above flood stage with more water on the way. It could crest by Friday. Also in Japan, a FedEx cargo plane crashed at Tokyo's main international airport today, killing the American pilot and co-pilot. John.
And we have pictures of that crash in Tokyo on our website, along with the pictures of the Mount Redoubt volcano erupting in Alaska. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The president has been everywhere over the last few days. Would you like to be his media advisor and tell us where he should go next?
I would like to see Barack Obama on The Daily Show. I think it would be wonderful.
Great show for you tonight. Historic show for you tonight. First time ever tonight on this program.
Could be. Where should the president show up next? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Also, are you more reassured when the president is behind closed doors working on the problems of the world, or when you see him out on the campaign trail, essentially meeting the American people and hearing their concerns? So you may not have known this, but yesterday is World Water Day. Was World Water Day. It supposedly highlights the problems faced in many developing countries and the fact that a billion people in the world have no access to clean water. But the clean water problem is also a problem, as many environmental problems are, of the fact that 6 billion people inhabit this earth, 6 billion people with their requirements for clean water and their production of all kinds of waste products that must be retired from the planet to sustain life. Joining us now is Rose George, who's author of the book Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, particularly why it matters to the availability of clean water throughout the globe. But Rose, on the line from London, thanks for being part of the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, certainly if you live in a normal home with running water, you certainly understand the connection between fresh water coming in and waste water going out. But how does that manifest itself in the biosphere, and why is it much more difficult today to keep waste water streams separate from clean water streams?
Well, the difficulty is that although 1 billion people have no access to clean water, 2.6 billion, that's twice as many people, have no access to sanitation. What that means is you've got a lot of people with absolutely no vessel or receptacle in which to do their business and to contain their potentially toxic waste. And so that is obviously getting into the water supply. So when we talk about waterborne diseases and water contamination, often that contamination is human or animal waste. And it has a huge public health impact around the world. Diarrhea is the second biggest killer of children under five. So the connection between sanitation and clean water is absolutely fundamental, but is often forgotten.
Now, in the developed world, we understand that running water and various kinds of hidden systems to deal with the waste stream and to deliver the clean water is how we get both of these problems solved. But does the Earth itself have any sort of straightforward biological system for dealing with waste? And is the number of humans on the planet simply overwhelming to whatever biological systems are there?
There are natural ways of dealing with waste. I mean, we have things called waste stabilization ponds, which do mimic nature's way of dealing with waste, and that involves organic bacteria, which simply munch it away, and it also involves sunshine, which can be a disinfectant and can clean waste water. But yes, there are simply, I think, too many humans and not enough effective ways of dealing with our waste, and in fact, sewage is the biggest marine pollutant on the planet, and that's a huge problem because that obviously affects environments and, again, affects health.
How do you take an issue that is so sort of unpleasant to talk about, involves so many sorts of moral and custom issues that keep it from being on the sort of straightforward agenda? How do you get something like this to be a matter of rights and political manifestos where people have a right to sanitation, and that's a part of the whole makings of government programs and international aid efforts?
Well, it's extremely difficult, and in fact, sanitation has been so profoundly neglected. I mean, there is a World Water Day, but it's not World Water and Sanitation Day. And I was at the World Water Forum in Turkey last week, and just looking down the list of events, they were pretty much all about clean water supply and not about sanitation. So it is difficult to get it onto the political agenda, but I think last year was the International Year of Sanitation, and I think there is a bit of momentum. Now, I think the key to getting politicians to take this seriously, because they clearly haven't, because we're in 2009, we have that enormous death toll from diarrhea, which is such a banal thing.
And celebrities are more likely to, be on a poster involving clean water. I mean, you're not going to see Gwyneth Paltrow being like the spokeswoman for diarrhea, right?
You're not, but I really wish she would, or someone would. Someone should step up to the latrine slab, because I often say Matt Damon does so much good work on clean water, and it's really a very simple, logical step to figure out that if you have a clean water supply in a village and you have no latrines and open defecation and human waste lying around all the place, it's obviously going to get into the water supply. So you really can't have one without the other. But the other thing that is... that's one thing a celebrity would really, really help. But the other thing is that it's a financial issue, and if we can... make politicians understand that if you invest a dollar in sanitation, you save $7 in health costs averted and labor days that you gain back because people are not sick from diarrhea every week. It's one of the most cost-effective health preventions we have.
That's 7 to 1.
7 to 1, and yet politicians just don't calculate this. And they,
you know, and we should remind people, this is not a word game. I mean, in the sense that people might say, well, you're talking about clean water. Everybody knows what that means. You're saying that explicit attention to sanitation is absolutely essential. You can't just generally talk about clean water without making this the top priority.
You can't, and clean water in many ways, like waterborne disease, is a euphemism, because water-related diseases is really a euphemism for fecal contamination of water. And yes, it's not a very palatable topic to many people, but I do think that people are more receptive to this issue, and it's simply that the issue has not been communicated properly. I think that is going to change, and there are some good organizations coming up and doing a lot more work and being less timid about making their case. I think the difficulty is there has been a timidity and an assumption that people do not want to hear about this. But my experience from writing this book, people do want to hear about it, and they are very sympathetic to this issue once it's communicated to them.
Well, getting away from timidity is a global issue, and the issue of sanitation. Rose George, author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, on the day after World Water Day, an important issue. Timidity out the door. Rose, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're also looking for your ideas on where President Obama should take his new show next. It was all over the tube last week. YouTube, Jay Leno, 60 Minutes. Tell us, would you rather hear Obama's message, or do you prefer him at work behind closed doors?
Hello, this is Tony Santiago calling from New Jersey. I prefer our president speaking directly to us. That's what leaders do. Tell me how bad it is and what you intend to do to fix it.
Well, there'll be more of that this week. News conference on Tuesday. Your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And Mark Garrison, we've got some time for headlines.
A little bit, 20 minutes before the hour. We're going to get fresh housing data a little bit later this weekend. The number on existing home sales, resales, is due out. Analysts expect it to be just about flat. An Oakland, California police officer is on life support today. Three others were shot and killed over the weekend in a deadly traffic stop of a man on parole. Yesterday, police initially thought the fourth officer had died. We now know he's brain dead, but remaining on life support while his family makes medical decisions. And Australian airport security is getting criticized today. This after travelers at Sydney's International Airport saw a man beaten to death in a huge weekend brawl. Police say more than a dozen men were involved, four in custody. They were apparently members of rival biker gangs.
At the airport? At
International Airport, in the terminal.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
Whoever.
Spaced out.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We want to look ahead on a story that you may have heard about over the weekend, a tragedy in Oakland, California. A parolee shot and killed four police officers, three of them killed, the fourth pronounced dead and on life support, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. Joining us now is Todd Clear, professor of criminal justice at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's on the line from Hoboken, New Jersey. Professor Clear, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Now, this was a situation where someone on parole was pulled over for, and we don't really know the circumstances, but it immediately erupted into this gunfire and this tragedy. What does this say about the difficulty of administering parole programs when you have officers maybe coming on a traffic situation and actually entering into a much more difficult, tense, and life or death kind of situation if they're dealing with a parolee?
Well, you know, police officers are taught that any traffic stop can erupt into a problem. That's extremely rare when it does, but obviously when it does, this is an awful, terrible tragedy for the families and the community of Oakland. But the problem is it doesn't tell us a whole lot about parole because it's such an extreme case. Sometimes these kinds of explosions in traffic stop situations happen when a person isn't on parole. But
certainly in the case of parole, if somebody knows that that they violated parole and that it's only a matter of time before the officer finds out, you're really coming on a situation that's fundamentally different, even with the precautions that you've described. And I'm wondering if there's any way to detect, to alert officers that they're dealing with a parolee even before they get out of the car.
Well, the protocols call for the police, when they do a traffic stop, to try to determine who the car is registered to, if there's any warrants out for the person it's registered to. So there's a whole series of precautionary measures police go through. They're not fail-safe, obviously. And they would apply to any situation in which there's a warrant. So again, we don't know a whole lot about the situation, but apparently there was a warrant out on this guy, and if the information had been linked to this automobile, then the police would have known that they were dealing with a person who was a suspect of a crime. So they would have approached the vehicle much more cautiously, although they do that anyway. But the point
but,
is...
But, Professor, let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, why would you send motorcycle cops, and that's what these were, to a situation if you actually did know that this could be a tense situation where an individual knew he was going back to prison?
When you make a vehicle stop, you have a series of steps you go through. You call in to find out information about the vehicle. I mean, car is completely approached, that's the stuff you go through. So, but I mean, again, the facts in this situation about exactly what happened is now being talked through, so no one really knows for sure how, you know, if and when mistakes were made. But the problem is that, you know, California is a state that has one of the toughest parole agencies in the country. They have the highest rate of revoking parolees for misbehavior that isn't criminal. So this is a situation that happened in California,
right,
where the parole system that already prides itself on trying to avoid any possibility of this situation arising.
But there's also...
You just can't, even though they're extremely rare, you can't make them never happen.
Right. Well, and certainly there's an overcrowding issue going on in California as well. The questions are definitely going to be asked. Terrible tragedy in Oakland, California over the weekend. Todd Clear, professor of criminal justice at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Thanks for helping us with that.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Solitary confinement, peace and quiet, or cruel and unusual punishment. The details in a moment, right after headlines with Mark Garrison.
Hey, John, 12 minutes before the hour. Any minute now, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is going to roll out the Obama administration program to relieve banks of their toxic assets. He could put up to $1 trillion towards the purchase, or $1 trillion of total purchases. Money will come from the Federal Reserve, FDIC, and private investors. Millionaires had a slightly less chance of being audited by the IRS. That's according to a new report by a tax watchdog group. The IRS disputes the conclusion. It says it was busy getting out last year's economic stimulus checks, also hindered by budget cutbacks. Overseas, Turkish President Abdullah Gül has arrived in Baghdad. It's the first visit by a Turkish head of state in more than 30 years. The Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, is expected to be the main topic. The group has used bases in northern Iraq to launch attacks inside Turkey in the past. John.
Thank you. And according to the Treasury, the private sector has to put up $300 billion to be in the game.
Yes.
On this $1 trillion. So that's interesting. And that's a test of whether they can actually do the loans that they're talking about.
Okay.
So the question for us in the next segment is torture. What is it? It was a debate throughout the Bush administration and throughout the political campaign. Both President Obama and Senator John McCain came out strongly to close Guantanamo Bay over the issue of torture. But the debate is moot if you consider this fact. The United States hold at least 20 35,000 prisoners in long-term solitary confinement prisons across the country, supermax prisons. 23 hours a day these people are confined. And are these detainees and is their treatment called torture? The debate doesn't really exist in the United States, but maybe it should. We're joined by Dr. Atul Gawande, a surgeon and writer for The New Yorker. He's agreed to talk to us from his office, and he spoke with us before he headed into surgery a little earlier this morning. Busy day, doctor, huh?
Thank you for having me on.
Yes, indeed. Well, you have a really an amazing piece in The New Yorker this week that's all about, first of all, the scientific data on the use of 23-hour-a-day solitary confinement in detention, which is routinely done in the United States, of tens of thousands of people, and just your own thoughts as a doctor on whether this constitutes torture. How did you calculate whether solitary confinement in supermax prisons could be considered torture?
Well, partly it was by trying to look at what the experience is, both in some scientific studies and of hostages and even prisoners of war like John McCain. What you see is that we've been learning over the last few decades that to exist as a normal human being requires interaction with people, and we've seen it in monkey studies. We've seen it when we've tried to adjust to how astronauts in space survive, especially on their own. It's turned out that radio and video connection to other human beings is really crucial for them to maintain their sanity. And then the experience of hostages and POWs has been that they find the torture of long-term solitary confinement, years, like John McCain spent 2.5 years in isolation, that can be worse to them than their physical damage of bones broken and other kinds of physical torture.
Now, of course, cynics in the audience might say, well, hey, John McCain, he did all right. He ran for president, you know, even though he was in solitary confinement. How permanent was the impact of that? And secondly, how does this policy of supermax solitary confinement proliferate in our prison system?
So the permanence issue, I started in an interest in this partly out of looking at John McCain when he ran, and it is striking that the data doesn't show that people necessarily have permanent effects that leave them disabled in some way mentally or anything like that, and John McCain is a great example of that. What you find over and over is that people who experience solitary confinement experience it as torture. You see that the brain slows down, and EEG studies taken weeks after solitary confinement for long periods show changes that are as severe as people who've had brain damage from abuse.
And in some of the animal studies, I mean, animals wouldn't eat and just basically starved themselves after solitary confinement in some of the most striking animal studies you cite.
That's right. So if you confine people long enough, and then they also have either they're very young, so you're confining juveniles to those kinds of – the equivalent of juveniles to those circumstances, that can lead to real permanent damage in their social abilities. But then also I look at a case of someone who was kept in solitary confinement in Illinois for 14 and a half years, basically from the age of 18 to the age of 33. And that kind of loss of your just social abilities means that they've lost the maturing of the ability to function in normal society. And so now we've freed this person who can't handle the world.
Well, before we go, how does this policy proliferate and what's to be done to sort out who's a physical danger to other inmates and who's just in solitary as a kind of a default practice?
Well, it's proliferated as an interesting finding as a consequence of our own generation. Before the 80s, we had maybe a few hundred people in solitary confinement, and we've made it our norm. And this isn't just in, a few states that we can all look down upon. I mean, that's 10% of the prisoners in Maine. We have supermax prisons here in Massachusetts, where I am, 8% of the prisoners in New York State. All over, we've made this our norm. I think that's contributed to our expectation that in Guantanamo, we could apply these kinds of conditions to foreign prisoners, and then we've been baffled at why other people have reacted to it. What we can do differently is there is experience, for example, in Britain, which stopped using solitary confinement after finding it made violence worse with IRA prisoners. They were able to establish ways to begin reducing prison violence, which is the main reason that, that people want to put people in solitary confinement. There's also a good third to a half who are in solitary confinement for smaller causes. It's merely an administrative decision to put them in solitary confinement. And there have been long recommendations from people in both parties that needs to change.
Well, you're a doctor, not a lawyer, but nevertheless, do you think it passes the test of cruel and unusual punishment, supermax solitary confinement?
I'm definitely not a lawyer, but I think it does. When we simply ask at the level of, is this straightforwardly harmful to people in ways that cause damage to them, lasting damage and pain that's at a level that is like breaking their arm, putting people in solitary confinement for years on end is.
Well, Dr. Atul Gawande, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck in surgery this morning. You have a busy day ahead of you. He joined us from his office in Boston to talk about his article in the current New Yorker, Hellhole, about the norm of housing inmates, 25,000 or more in U.S. prisons in 23-hour solitary confinement. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
And, you know, we could call this the excellent adventure of Femi Oke. Femi, are you there?
Good morning, John. How are you doing?
So you're not doing the news. I found that out when I came in this morning because you're off on your own adventure. Explain this now.
It's Femi in the field, basically. So I'm going to be out and about reporting stories back into the Takeaway all of this week. And I'm also teaming up with Jennifer Hsu. Now, if you've ever seen thetakeaway.org and you've seen those great little videos and vignettes that you see online, that's the work of Jen Hsu. So Jen and myself, we're going to be out and about. And really, issue number one is going to be the story that we're looking at, the economy. So if any of our listeners have stories that they want us to cover about the economy, the success stories, the stories that aren't going so well, the personal stories that we're maybe not looking at on the show, this is your chance to actually send me wherever you want me to go. Now, there are some sort of geographical issues around here because obviously I'd love to go to the Caribbean and
I see.
Love to go to South Africa.
Is the economy a problem in Ibiza?
The economy is a problem on the Takeaway's budget, so I will be reporting round and about the New York area. So really for our New York listeners or any listeners actually around the country, if you've got a story where you feel you'd like me to delve into with more detail, then this is your chance to actually send me out and about.
Be a part of Femi and Jen's excellent adventure at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org all week long on the Takeaway. By the way, after that conversation about supermax prisons a moment ago, we heard from someone in New Jersey.
My name is Sean. From Bradley Beach. Should we really be worried about prisoners in 23-hour solitary confinement? Most of the time, they're there for a very good reason. And they are there for their own protection, the protection of other prisoners, and the protection of the correction officers.
Let's talk about the president for a moment. Also, something that you've been contacting us about. Would you rather see the president at work in front of the camera or behind closed doors?
This is Milton from Roslyn. Personally, I can't see enough of President Obama. He never ceases to impress me with his intelligence and sense of humor.
The Obama Media Blitz critiqued on our program this morning. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. And what should you watch for this week? Well, here's the agenda.
The story this week is going to be this. It's going to be Moneypalooza. So you got banks, you got budget, and you got bailout.
Waiting for Tim Geithner. That's Marcus Mabry from the New York Times. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You You know, it turns out for certain institutions, size matters.
There are certain institutions that are so big that if they fail, they bring a lot of other financial institutions down with them.
If you're big enough, no one will let you fail. It's Obama's financial paradox, and it leads straight to the U.S. Treasury. Taxpayers apparently not too big to fail. Obamanomics on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, March 23rd. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, we take a look at President Obama's communication strategy. He's been everywhere. Also, the latest on the NCAA March Madness tournament, and we talk about how antidepressants, maybe I should take a few, can interfere with our ability to fall in love. All that coming up. But first, these headlines. Cornflakes for breakfast. How about Geithner? He's running about 15 minutes late, but he's supposed to unveil his plan for the government's trillion-dollar buyup of the bank's bad assets. Money will come from the Federal Reserve, FDIC, and private investors. Details shortly. The Alaska Volcano Observatory has labeled the state's Mount Redoubt code color red. That's because it's erupted four times today. Geophysicist John Power.
These are large explosive eruptions that are throwing ash plumes, plumes of volcanic ash, up to as high as 50,000 feet. So very significant explosive eruptions of the volcano.
Commercial aircraft, look out! This is the first time Mount Redoubt has erupted in nearly 20 years. A private plane crashed last night in Butte, Montana's Holy Cross Cemetery. The Federal Aviation Administration says all 14 people on board were killed. The cause of the accident is not yet known. Mark Garrison, what else is going on?
Good morning, John. Another plane crash, this one in Japan. A FedEx cargo plane crashed among high winds at Tokyo's main airport today, killing the American pilot and co-pilot. The plane was en route from China. Investigators are taking a look at what happened. President Obama says preventing an attack by al-Qaeda is his number one priority from Afghanistan. Here's another clip from the interview on CBS's 60 Minutes last night.
What we can't do is think that just a military approach in Afghanistan is going to be able to solve our problems. So what we're looking for is a comprehensive strategy, and there's got to be an exit strategy.
To do that, the president says the U.S. will have to ramp up its diplomatic efforts in the region in addition to increasing troops. Later today, the president's focus will be on energy. He's expected to talk up the part of the budget that deals with clean energy technology. He wants to put billions toward it, part of the plan to move the U.S. toward energy independence.
Energy and healthcare this week is going to be a part of what the president wants to shift the attention to. We were talking about the president's communication strategy all morning on The Takeaway. You can critique it at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Is he better than Tim Geithner, who's now 17 minutes late in unveiling his bank bailout plan? The Dow and the S&P both fell about 2% on Friday. The futures market was way, way up, anticipating Geithner's announcement. With each minute he's late, it falls about 10 points. The S&P starts trading at 769. So we were saying a moment ago, President Obama has been hard to miss. Where should he pop up next? Saturday Night Live sketch, maybe? You be the media advisor for the president. And would you rather hear his message out in public or prefer him working behind closed doors? Your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. You behind closed doors guy, Mark, or what are you, public guy?
Let's hear him talk.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to talk in just a moment with Kathleen Hall Jamieson, as the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, about Barack Obama's media strategy and his attempts to connect directly with the American people. But we also want your views on that. Where should he be next? He was all over the media last week. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And generally, What reassures you the most, seeing your president in action or knowing he or she is behind the scenes working on the problems of the world? Does that reassure you more? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So it was a moment of candor last night on 60 Minutes that really bears repeating. Listen.
The hardest thing about the job is staying focused because there's so many demands and decisions that are pressed upon you.
Staying focused. Barack Obama talking with Steve Croft last night on 60 Minutes. Joining us now is Kathleen Hall Jamison. Kathleen, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
I certainly don't want to waste my time with you here at the top of the show talking about the likability factors of Barack Obama, which are endlessly discussed. But here is an individual. Talk about that staying focused idea, who has so many opportunities to connect with the American people. There's a 24/7 news cycle that has, that exploded during the campaign and has really continued throughout the first days of the Obama presidency. You've got him all over the media last week. Is he driving this, or is he responding to a tremendous interest in the success of his very popular presidency so far?
I think he's doing both. And in an environment in which you have 24-hour news, the danger is that people talking about you creates the public's context for viewing what it is you're doing. So a candidate in this age behaves in a way that tries to gain as much unfiltered access to the public, and now a president in this age apparently is doing the same thing.
So it's the same problem for a candidate. You've got to upstage the people who are talking about you, which means you've got to be on more, which runs the risk of tiring people out.
Or if you do it well, it creates a different kind of presidency, one in which we come to expect that part of the role of the president is at the desk solving the problems, but part of the role is functioning as educator-in-chief, explaining to the public what the challenges are and how we're going to get to solutions. Mobilizing the public to endorse presidential action is as much a part of the job as taking presidential action, particularly when you've got the economy as a central issue, and confidence in the economy is in part going to determine whether or not the economy rebounds.
You know, it seems to me the Obama presidency takes the communicator notion of Ronald Reagan to a whole different level of complexity. Listen to this moment on 60 Minutes last night, where you can hear Barack Obama really struggling with the essential contradiction of the office, to be accessible and sort of friendly and reassuring, but also to be serious and presidential. Listen to this.
The only thing less popular than putting money into banks is putting money into the auto industry.
18% are in favor. 76% against.
It's not a high number.
You're sitting here and you are laughing about some of these problems. Are people going to look at this and say, I mean, he's sitting there just making jokes about money with them? How do you deal with it? I mean, explain the your mood and your laughter.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be.
Are you punch drunk?
No, there's got to be a little gallows humor to get you through the day.
Now, listen to that. I mean, Steve Croft, of course, not helping at all, as no member of the media should, but the president, you know, walking this line between being relaxed and expressing urgency.
And in the process, reframing his laughter, not as, you know, laughing at, but as a kind of coping mechanism, and trying to signal the public that, you know, it's all right in these times to laugh, provided that we stay focused on the problem. This is a very sophisticated media strategy, and it's one that gambles that the president is adept enough to continue to control those moments in which he's being interviewed so that gotcha moments or inadvertent statements do not come to characterize his presidency negatively, but instead frame it as someone working hard, coping well, staying on message.
But it's got to be beyond simply staying on message. Again, that was something that was invented in the sort of Reagan era, it seemed to me, and moved into a whole different kind of photo op White House strategy during the Clinton era. But now you've also got way beyond simply appealing to the American people over the heads of Congress and pundits. You've got Barack Obama calling out his campaign army to basically go onto the street and advocate for the budget. Does this kind of thing have any precedent, and does it work?
Well, first, that is part of staying on message, because essentially what the presidency is now doing is handing the volunteers from the campaign the president's message that, incidentally, you've also heard from him. So you've got that consistency and then carrying it through. Does it potentially work? It depends on whether those volunteers act on the request to go out and talk to neighbors and whether they stay on message. But listen to what you've heard across the last week and a half. You've heard that the president has an unprecedented number of problems. You've heard this from him, and that who would have imagined a year ago that someone would have said that Iraq wasn't the most urgent, although it remains urgent. Suppose you hear that in conversation with your neighbors after having heard it from the president. You now have another layer of agenda setting working to increase the likelihood that that's what you talk about when you talk to someone who is not a Barack Obama volunteer.
Well, certainly the domestic problem of the economy really lends itself to a domestic kind of foot soldier strategy for staying on message. When people see volunteers on the street or see Barack Obama, are they looking at a Democrat or are they looking at someone who transcends party? And if so, if so, he transcends party, what is the GOP to do? They've so far stayed really out of this debate, saying no more spending. We're going to stay in this kind of tax and spend tent and wait for the next presidential cycle.
If they see someone who's a Democrat, then the strategy is failing. The strategy only works if you say, I know what the president is saying to me about these issues. And whether I agree with him or not, I do understand why he's doing what he's doing. The problem for the Republicans is they don't have the ability to gain unfiltered access or lightly filtered access anytime that they want, and they don't have a single individual who speaks for party. That's the disadvantage of the U.S. system for the party out of power and the advantage that you've got in a British system. And so you've got a situation in which you're hearing disparate voices from the Republicans, and they're not on a consistent message. And as a result, net advantage to the White House.
But Kathleen Hall Jamison, you've also suggested that there's a whole other twist here as well, that part of the media strategy of Barack Obama is to separate himself as well from Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, the Democrats in Congress, that he's got to transcend them as well. They begin to look a little more like a traditional opposition than even the GOP. Am I right or wrong?
Well, and they get less total airtime with a message that might undercut his because he's now becoming the voice that speaks for that point of view. So unless they differ dramatically, they're more likely to look as if they're just bickering children. The contest becomes one in which if they take any exception, the media frame them as being the opposition, and that could be highly problematic. But it could also be beneficial because they're the Washington insiders. He's the Washington outsider then, trying to represent the people he's talking to directly. If the strategy succeeds, it makes it more difficult for them to take exception from him, and it keeps his Washington outsider posture. If it fails, he becomes highly accountable for every single policy he's articulated because there are no cabinet people who have comparable kinds of roles
right.
to cabinets in the past fronting the administration's arguments, hence people he can distance from when the policy runs into problems.
So his transcendent role, if he fails, becomes isolated and more like a Jimmy Carter rather than FDR. Before we go, let's look at Barack Obama. And again, it's easy to kind of overemphasize the smarts here, but this guy is pretty darn good. Here in talking with Steve Croft, it sounds to me like he's answering Steve Croft's question, but he's talking to all of the media here.
They need to spend a little time outside of New York because, you know, if you go to North Dakota or you go to Iowa or you go to Arkansas, where folks would be thrilled to be making $75,000 a year without a bonus, then I think they'd get a sense of why people are frustrated.
He's answering Steve Croft's AIG question that the bonuses are needed to retain these people in New York. His statement, get outside of New York, is really a warning to the media, it seems.
It is, and it also reminds you that you've seen him outside New York in town halls across the country, and as a result that he is, and they're again replaying their campaign theme, in touch with the middle class and Washington outsider, in this case New York outsider, but not someone inside
right.
the power structures that create problems.
Well, a big strategy, a complex strategy. Will it succeed or fail? We'll be checking in with Kathleen Hall Jamison again. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning again, everyone. So last week, Barack Obama all over the country, all over the media. This week, all over Washington, solving problems. Which do you prefer? And where else should Barack Obama pop up? What other forum? Maybe Saturday Night Live, Law & Order? One of you told us, I want to see Barack on Inside the Actor's Studio on Bravo. It's a funny thing how he does a great job showing rage about these AIG bonuses. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Staying on message? What do you say? We go off message. Off message and on to March Madness with Will Leach, contributing editor and columnist at New York Magazine and founder of Deadspin.com. Will, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course, my pleasure, sir.
March Madness, the NCAA basketball tournament, if you don't follow it, you're still affected by it because it seems to be a chance to go back to college, depending on where you went to school, a chance to see basketball competition outside of the sometimes very annoying NBA, even though they do shoot better, and also to see a Cinderella team go from nowhere to possibly taking it all. Any chance that those things will happen this year?
Certainly the underdog idea is probably already over, actually. You know, one of the great things about the tournament is that for one day or even a whole weekend, a sleepy town in Louisiana, like where Northwestern State is from, who beat Iowa a couple years ago, can become the center of the sports universe.
Well, hey, there's always Gonzaga. Now, if you could recognize anything that was said in there, it was just Gonzaga going to the Sweet 16. Gonzaga, of course, in Western Washington, a great school. I lived in the Pacific Northwest. It's in an area of the American Indian area of Western Washington. It's typically does better than anyone ever expects, but it has never really made it all the way.
Yeah, well, that's one of the funny things is that probably the closest thing to a Cinderella left is Gonzaga, which is funny because they've actually probably become a typical powerhouse now. They were number 4 seed.
Right.
In their region, certainly would be expected to have gone this far. So you're kind
so
of
they're an official Cinderella.
Yeah, they're officially sponsored. They're one of the corporate sponsors. They're corporate champions, yeah. as the NCAA and CBS called them. But yeah, that's actually as close as you're going to get this year. This has been very much a chalk bracket, as the idea.
Right.
All of the 1, 2, and 3 seeds in each bracket made it, and that's the first time that's happened since they went to the 64-65 team bracket.
Well, let's talk about the 1 seeds. I mean, you've got UConn. The major issue is not so much its basketball play, but what's going on with the coach.
Yeah, yeah. He'd had some illness in the past, and then he missed the first round game this year with dehydration. He came back for the second round. Connecticut's looked actually very dominant. They were considered the weakest of the number 1 seeds, but they've looked better than probably any other team in the tournament so far. They've got they get to face the much maligned and my beloved Big Ten this month. They play Purdue. The Big Ten only had 2 teams make the Sweet 16 out of 17 making the tournament. Many people don't like the Big Ten.
Well, I mean, that's really the other story here. Yeah. The Big Ten is irrelevant, and a lot of people resent their overrepresentation in this.
Yeah, you know, and I, as a University of Illinois graduate and someone who is sad to watch them lose in the first round, I would make the argument that I think it's just a different style of basketball, and it's perhaps not as exciting to watch. That North Carolina-Gonzaga game is probably going to be the most fun game to watch because they're not strong defensive teams. I think a lot of times college basketball puts more of an emphasis on defense, which I think is fine during the regular season, but during the tournament, and people tend to like a lot of scoring, and you'll see that in that game and with a lot of the Big East teams.
Obama gave his Final Four picks very publicly, Pittsburgh being one of them, it seems to me. How does that affect the sort of brackety geekdom of the NCAA tournament, where people in their office pools, you know, spend weeks just immersed in this?
Yeah, he had a hard time in the first round, but he's actually come back around. He's done pretty well. He has North Carolina winning it all. It's funny. This year is many people always say that the person that doesn't watch basketball during the regular season is the one that does well in the pool. This would be a good example of that. This is not a year to pick upsets. if you just picked the higher seed, you're probably in pretty good shape in your bracket. It hasn't been a year to go nuts. But yeah, that's one of the fun parts about it, is that, like, no matter what, if you don't care about basketball, there's something, even just the brackets and the construction of them, it's a fun thing for everyone.
And who cannot fall in love with this moment?
Missouri by one, and they're eating the towel on that Marquette bench. English, unbelievable freshman, cool as can be. One more, got them both.
Kim English off the bench for Missouri,
freshman
wins it. For Missouri over Marquette there. That's a great story. But buried, right, in the final round?
Yeah, well, so there's actually a very sad, very human moment in that game where right after that second free throw, Marquette went to throw the ball in bounds for the last shot, and the guy throwing the ball in bounds got nervous and stepped on the in line without even throwing the ball in. It's just a classic college moment where I don't even remember this guy's name. Most people will never remember his name. They'll just remember it was that poor guy in Marquette that everyone was watching and had a very bad moment on national television.
Yeah, let's help the poor guy on suicide watch up there in Marquette. This weekend, that's for sure. Well, Will Leach, do you have picks you want to give us before we go?
I picked Pittsburgh to win the whole thing. I still think they're the best team. But one of the best things about the next weekend, next Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there's nothing but good teams left. There really aren't any crazy underdogs that are going to struggle. All eight games Thursday and Friday should be between pretty powerhouse teams.
Well, I'm going to be watching Gonzaga at NC State. Will Leach, thanks so much for joining us. Will Leach is the contributing editor and columnist at New York Magazine, founder Deadspin.com. And what's your pick, Mark Garrison, with the headlines?
I don't know. I haven't done an official bracket, so I won't wade into this one like that. But I will say it's 28 minutes after the hour. We're watching existing home sales. That number's due out later this morning. That's something to watch. It basically counts the number of resales, homes that are already out there, different than new home sales. I mean, basically, if people are feeling good about their pocketbooks, they're going to buy homes. Let's move to international news, where incoming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secured another agreement in his coalition building to form Israel's next government. The leader designate has until April 3rd to secure a full coalition in order to assume office. Netanyahu is now one support of the Orthodox Jewish Shas Party. So far, he's formed agreements with 53 of the 120 officials of parliament. Netanyahu will talk with Labor next. Their Labor Party is actually scheduled to vote tomorrow. There's an ash plume extending 9 miles high from Alaska's Mount Redoubt volcano today. The volcano began erupting overnight. The National Weather Service is predicting ash to start falling later today. John Power is a geophysicist at the Alaska Volcano Observatory. He says the ash can be problematic.
The principal hazard is to aircraft that may be flying in the area. Ash clouds are very, very hazardous to the operation of aircraft.
They chew up the engines.
If you get that in those turbines, yeah. it's a problem. Right. So they're able to do that. So they're watching for that. They say, though, it's not going to be – there isn't enough ash to get it over some of the main cities there. So they're watching that. But, planes are staying away. They're going to keep watching. It's been 20 years since that thing blew.
20 years. Yeah. On that Israel story, the Shas Party, you mentioned it's an Orthodox party. But the reason it's politically significant is it's Sephardic. It's Middle Eastern Jews. And they're huge voting bloc in Israel.
There's always deals about military service and a kingmaker role. Exactly. Sometimes.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Hey, some people don't update their blog for an entire year. But President Obama, no, that's not him. It's updated twice, three times a day. He does a weekly video spot on YouTube. That's also on the White House site. He's been on Jay Leno, 60 Minutes. He's holding a press conference tomorrow. Where else should he pop up? Say, American Idol?
I do think in Washington, it's a little bit like American Idol, except everybody is Simon Cowell.
Wow. Absolutely useless.
Useless.
Sorry, I didn't like it. Hated the vocal, didn't like anything about it.
So imagine where your president will be next at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Be a media advisor to the Obama presidency, the Obama White House, 877-8-MY-TAKE. So by 2005, 170 million antidepressant prescriptions were filled. That's right. It's an enormous number of prescriptions, and it means that the manifestations of using those drugs on a regular basis by that number of people is going to have large-scale effects on our society. And what could those be? Joining us is Helen Fisher, professor of anthropology at Rutgers University, who wants to talk about the kinds of mechanisms that antidepressant drugs mess with in our brains and what sorts of social consequences that could mean. One suggestion you posit is that people may have a much more difficult time falling in love if they're on antidepressants, which possibly ignores the fact that if you're depressed, you're probably not doing very well romantically anyway. But why did you pose this question, Professor? And why do antidepressants possibly interfere with our ability to attract, to fall in love, to find a mate?
I think the most important thing to remember is that there are some people who really need these antidepressants,
sure.
And I'm not suggesting that they should get off of them. I'm not a medical doctor, but I do study the brain. I mean, there really are people who have medical imbalances, and they need these drugs to get out of bed and to preserve their relationships and to find
sure.
love. And,
no, and we're not really debating the question of whether they're a good idea
yeah.
or not, but at 170 million prescriptions,
right.
it starts to have anthropological implications.
Well, not only that, but psychiatrists now say that as much as 75% of people who are on these drugs don't really need them.
Hmm.
And that's what the population that I'm talking about. And it's not just all the millions of people in the United States. These drugs have now gone generic, and they're all over the world. Now, there's a lot of different kinds of antidepressants, but the ones I'm particularly concerned about are the SSRIs, the ones that boost serotonin in the brain.
And possibly inhibit dopamine production.
Yeah, and the medical textbooks basically say that there's a negative correlation between the serotonin and the dopamine systems in the brain. So as you are boosting serotonin, you are suppressing the dopamine circuit. And I and my colleagues have now put 49 people who are madly in love into a brain scanner. And very basic to the experience of falling in love and remaining in love with a partner is elevated activity in the dopamine system of the brain. So as you take these antidepressants and drive up the serotonin, you are suppressing the dopamine system. And we know that, I mean, you know, when you take antidepressants, they blunt the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons people take them. And what is romantic love but an incredible ecstasy, an emotional high? So you can even, and I tell you, I mean, you not only...
Put that in a bottle, I guess, and you can be more successful in the antidepressant industry.
Well, I'm sure that... There's cognitive processes
yeah.
to falling in love, too. You don't fall in love with everybody. But long and short is it is a chemical experience, and you are blunting that chemical experience when you take SSRIs.
Part of the question you're posing here is let's have more research on this
Absolutely.
Complicated system of serotonin and dopamine transfer that it basically is involved in a lot of human activity and could even affect people's judgment on a whole range of circumstances.
Yeah. I think we've evolved three distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction. One is a sex drive, the second is romantic love, and the third is attachment, that sense of calm and security you can feel for a long-term partner. And when you kill the sex drive, in 73% of people who take SSRIs and boost serotonin, they kill the sex drive. And when you kill the sex drive, you are jeopardizing not only feelings of romantic love, but also feelings of attachment, because if you don't climb in bed with your partner, you don't have an orgasm. And orgasm with orgasm, there's a real
I've
flood.
I've noticed that.
Well, I'm glad a lot of people
right.
have.
Yeah.
When you don't have an orgasm, you are not getting a flood of oxytocin and vasopressin, which is associated with attachment. So you can not only jeopardize feelings of falling in love, but feelings of deep attachment to a long-term partner.
Now, doctors might say kill the sex drive is a little strong for these drugs. Are you going to stick with that, kill the sex drive?
It kills more than the sex drive. Okay, 73% of people have problems with sexual desire, sexual arousal, and erection and orgasm. So it creates dysfunction. You know, you can go off these drugs and have drug holidays, and particularly in drugs that have a short half-life. But long and short of it is there's a great deal of evidence that it, okay, I'll step away from kills, but it certainly jeopardizes it dramatically. Right. And, you know, I get emails from people all the time saying, well, you know, I got on these drugs because I was doing poorly in school, and I suddenly didn't have any sex drive, but I also realized I didn't love my partner. And then they get off the drugs, and by then the partner's gone, and they realize that the romantic love floods back, and they don't have the partner anymore.
Now, is it possible that this is a small price to pay to deal with the urgency of depression, which, you know, can lead people to, you know, ending their own lives if not treated?
Well, I think that we're not talking about those kinds of people. The problem is that people get on these drugs often for very good reasons, but then they stay on them when the depression is lifted. And nobody's told them that there could be complications. I mean, I think what the medical community has to realize is that when you jeopardize one large brain system, you're likely to jeopardize others. If they started to at least inform their patients that there could be some negative side effects to your feelings of romantic love and attachment.
So quickly before we go, better information on side effects for patients who get these drugs, and study what to help us answer which question here?
Well, I think we've got to start studying the impact of these of SSRIs, serotonin boosters, on all kinds of brain systems so that we get to the bottom of these complicated relationships.
More research, the manifesto going forward, from Helen Fisher, professor of anthropology at Rutgers University. Thanks so much for being with us, and I guess you could say I'm comfortably numb. There's no antidote to Floyd. No. Except for Mark Garrison with the headlines. Mark, thanks for
doing
joining
my
us.
Best. 21 minutes before the hour.
What, you can't?
No, it wasn't soundtrack-based kind of thing like that.
Right.
But we'll start
right.
internationally. The Turkish President Abdullah Gül is visiting Iraq today. That's significant because it's the first time a Turkish head of state has visited its neighbor in some three decades. Gül will meet with top Iraqi leaders. One issue that's been of longstanding contention is the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. The group has previously attacked Turkey from bases in northern Iraq. The visit is being seen in Turkey as an attempt to shore up relations with Iraq as U.S. troops prepare to withdraw. The FAA says seven children were among the 14 killed in an airplane crash in Montana yesterday.
That's horrible.
It was a tough crash, and witnesses are still trying to figure out what's going on. I mean, people that saw it, they said it jerked and nosedived just ahead of the airport, and it was so dramatic, people thought it was some kind of stunt flight or something.
Ski vacation.
Yeah, so they were headed there, and there were no survivors. The NTSB is taking a look at what happened. Let's go to North Dakota, where hundreds of National Guard troops and volunteers in the Fargo area are setting up a massive sandbagging operation already underway. Residents are bracing for a major flood along the Red River. That area flooded in 97, and emergency officials hope some of the changes they made, levees they've built after that flood, will make it reduce damage this time.
Markets open, bouncing, and that fourth officer in the Oakland police shooting tragedy on life support.
Life support,
right?
Yeah. Correct.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and we're joined now by one of our colleagues at our partner, The New York Times, Randy Archibald, who's national correspondent for The New York Times. He's in Los Angeles. As part of a series, The Times is beginning examining the influence and impact of drug cartels on both sides of the U.S. and Mexican border. We've talked a lot about the instability in border towns like Juarez and Tijuana. But Randy Archibald finds that the impact of instability inside Mexico goes far afield from the border. Randy, what have you found?
Good morning, John. Basically, there are some cities in the United States that believe they're feeling something of a ripple effect from the drug violence down south or the influence of the cartels as they spread further into the U.S., Tucson, Phoenix, Atlanta, Houston, even as far north as Vancouver. Some of the police there believe that there's been a spike in drug-related crime that, although connecting the dots is very difficult, they sort of put two and two together and get, four. But whether it's directly related or not is something of a debate.
But there are two trends here. One is the proliferation of the drugs themselves and drugs attempting to find a market. And the other one, possibly, which you allude to in your story, is the potential safety, that it's conceivable that individuals from Mexico are seeking a kind of refuge in the United States because they're not being sort of searched for in the way that the Calderon government is searching for members of the drug cartels in northern Mexico right now.
That's true. I mean, there is some signs of cartel members of their families crossing over and seeking sort of safe haven on the U.S. side, and that is, of course, very alarming to the Department of Homeland Security and the DEA and other law enforcement officials.
So how does Alaska figure into your story?
How does Alaska figure into my
right.
story? Anchorage is actually one of those cities that the Justice Department in December released a report assessing the spread of the cartels and identifying 230 U.S. cities where either the cartels or related drug trafficking organizations, they call them, had been identified, and Alaska was one of those places. It should be noted that there has been a surge of immigration from Mexico and Latin America to Alaska to work in the various blue-collar jobs up there. And while it's not true that most of those immigrants are involved in the drug trade, the drug trafficking organizations often seek cover in those populations. They kind of try to blend in and establish new markets and you know, use those ties to do their trade.
So finally, before we go, if this is the leading edge of a trend that's going to proliferate in communities around the United States, are members of law enforcement ready for what might happen in the next year or two?
That certainly is an important question that I think Congress is trying to get at. I do know there are members of the Senate that are certainly a little skeptical of whether the DEA and other agencies are prepared for this.
All right. Well, Randy Archibald, you're part of this series that the New York Times is beginning, examining the influence and impact of drug cartels from Mexico on both sides of the border. Some tantalizing stuff there in the early going. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
Randy Archibald is the national correspondent for the New York Times. He joined us from Los Angeles.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Bit of a stock rally in the early going. The futures bore out correctly. The Dow's up about 160 points. President Obama has been hard to miss. Richard emailed us, "We've gotten lip service on education, energy, and healthcare for 30-plus years. Let's use this economic horrible time to fix these things and put our nation on the road to a healthier future. If we go under, so be it," he says. "But better to go down trying than to go down talking." Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Basically, are you more reassured if the president is out in public or behind the scenes solving problems? Now, not Femi, okay, but Mark Garrison has the headlines.
That's me. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, the West Bank-based Palestinian group Fatah says a senior official has been killed in a large explosion in Lebanon. We've seen pictures of this coming in. Fatah calls it an assassination. We'll follow that.
And it's southern Lebanon, so it's Hamas territory down there.
Correct, yep. Yeah. And then Hamas, Syria's next door.
Or Hezbollah. Hezbollah, rather, yeah.
Right. And the Obama administration released details today on its new public-private partnership investment program, the apparent affinity for alliteration at the Treasury. The P-heavy praise is basically the plan to buy toxic assets from banks, at least $75 billion in bailout money, also money coming in from the Federal Reserve, FDIC, also low interest loans to entice the private investors to join in. So that's what we got.
Yeah, it's got two plane crashes this morning. It's really
a lot going on.
Crazy day. Thank you, Mark. So James Balog, you may not know him, but he's a nature photographer for 30 years, a nature photographer, and he's the founder of the Extreme Ice Survey. James, I want you to help me out here. Can you just pitch to me the original idea of your movie about ice? I want to do a movie for National Geographic and NOVA on watching ice melt.
Well,
it really, the core of it wasn't really about the movie. The core of it was that we have 27 time-lapse cameras all around the northern hemisphere watching these glaciers melt, and we're collecting this incredible evidence of climate change, and it's a very adventurous, very physical, very dynamic process to get out there, make these cameras work, and record what's happening in our world right now. So it actually was a really, really easy sell. It wasn't so much about the ice melting. It was about the human drama of actually getting out there and doing it.
And who would have thought how emotional it all was? Listen.
Not supposed to be able to witness things like this. Human beings don't generally get to see these massive features of the landscape changing and vanishing in front of your eyes.
Now, that soundtrack I'll compare with, like, my cup of ice here that I have in the studio. What you managed to get in these pictures that appear in your book, Extreme Ice Now, and also in the film on Nova that you're the subject of, are, I have to say, stunning pictures that are also a little bit sad about the state of the planet. They're beautiful. They're scary. The places you went were kind of insane. How did you feel in the middle of all that, besides, as you say, feeling like you weren't on planet Earth?
Yeah, it's a strange combination of exhilarating, as you say, because it's so beautiful and dramatic and you're in these fantastic places, and eerie as well as depressing. It's eerie in the sense that you feel like you're witnessing time passing by. You feel very mortal, and you feel your own human life fluttering along at the same time you see these massive landscape features disappearing. And of course it's sad because it's such a statement about what's happening on the planet today. You know, it takes the pictures take something that seems relatively abstract to people and makes it very, very real. 95% of the glaciers on the planet outside Antarctica are melting right now. And people understand what that means. You know, it doesn't take a computer model or a PhD to understand that when ice melts, it means something.
Well, a lot of people have seen the Al Gore, you know, PowerPoint pictures from satellite shots of retreating glaciers and things. There's just something about this down at ground level that gives you a whole different impression. And I'm reminded of looking at a beautiful sunset and having somebody tug on your ear and say, you know what, if it's that colorful, that means there's something wrong with the atmosphere. You found that same kind of thing with ice, right?
Yeah. It brought it very down home and very real and very alive. I was actually motivated by the fact that I think that satellite pictures are too distant, too abstract. You know, you're too disconnected from it. But when you can see changes, incremental changes, progressive changes happening right down at ground level, in the place where human beings stand and live and relate to the planet, it gives you a whole different take on it. And it's I find it a great privilege as a photographer to be able to do this right now. At the same time, I feel a tremendous responsibility to tell the story as widely as possible.
In Greenland, how did you reconcile the beauty of the melted ice that you could see on the ice floe in Greenland with the peril that it represents?
I don't think there really is a reconciliation of that. You just deal with the dichotomies, and that's a lot of what I have tried to do with my work over the past 25 years, where I'm poking my finger into some very tough subjects in some cases, endangered species or deforestation, and now climate change, and you try and pull people in with the beauty and the drama. At the same time, you use that as a way to deliver a what can be quite a dark message, but it has to be done.
Now, where would I be most likely to have the same sort of experience? In other words, what's the most accessible place for someone to actually visit and see this ice melt firsthand?
Well, you know, Glacier National Park in Montana is a place where it's happening very, very quickly. That's, of course, right here in the lower 48 and the Pacific Northwest. The glaciers in Washington State and in Oregon, as well as in Montana, are dwindling very, very quickly. Glacier National Park probably won't have glaciers 30 to 50 years from now, if current trends continue. Another place where you can see this quite easily is in the European Alps, which are those glaciers, huge glaciers, much, much bigger than we have in the lower 48, are vanishing quite rapidly.
And what about Bolivia? You went into the Andes to some places that aren't well studied. Any surprises up there?
No, sort of the same story. It's the same story, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and all the way down through Chile. You know, it's this is a global phenomenon. This is not isolated to a few oddball cases here in the Northern Hemisphere. As I said, 95% of the glaciers outside Antarctica are shrinking.
Can you give me a sense for the sculpturing of the ice that you witnessed firsthand, particularly in Greenland, where temperature is one story, but the impact of running water is quite another one on the shapes and texture of this crazy substance called ice?
Yeah, I was completely shocked at the variability that I saw in the forms and how this fantastic dynamic interaction between atmosphere, water, and ice creates this ever-changing variation in the sculptures. Variation is such a dry word. I mean, it creates these unique, fantastic art forms in each different area. The glaciers, oddly enough, in different parts of the world, produce different kinds of forms depending on local circumstances. And it's sort of this endless fascination and endless quest to try and do justice to those and celebrate them and put them on film.
So for 30 years, a nature photographer, where does this project fit into your long career?
Well, I've always believed that the intersection of humans and the environment is one of the great, great critical stories of our era. I think it's clearly a story that's going to go on for you know, centuries, more or less, indefinitely, actually. And so all of my projects have fit around this question of the relationship of humans and nature. And I feel like my entire adult life has actually led me to this ICE project. It's exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Well, James Balog, thanks so much for being a part of the program this morning.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Over the last 40 years, temperatures here in Alaska have risen about 4 degrees Fahrenheit, twice as fast as the global average. Now, these rivers of ice are flowing faster and crashing even more spectacularly into the sea.
Literally cooling his heels, that's our guest James Balog from the movie Extreme Ice. It's a new Nova National Geographic co-production, which premieres Tuesday, March 24th on PBS. That's this Tuesday. Check your local listings for airtimes. Nova is a production of WGBH. Those are our partners up there in Boston. We've been talking all morning about President Obama, the media maven. He's already been on 60 Minutes and YouTube and Jay Leno, for example. Here's one way to tell if his media magic is going to work on the people.
If they see someone who's a Democrat, then the strategy's failing. The strategy only works if you say, I know what the president is saying to me.
Your takeaway this morning comes from Kathleen Hall Jamieson from the University of Pennsylvania critiquing the media strategy of the president. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. That's a great interview to podcast. Sports fans, you'll also want to download that interview about March Madness with Will Leach from New York Magazine. Gail had an interesting take on that.
I am listening to your piece on basketball, and I am astonished how you were talking as if the men's game is the only one that matters and that there are no surprises. For me, the fact that Tennessee lost in the first round for the first time ever is the surprise. And of course, I'm talking about the Tennessee women, because the women's game is really where it's at.
So right. We're wrong. Typically, our listeners save our butts here on The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.